Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. On this week's podcast, outgoing U.S. Rep. Brenda Lawrence shares some of her most memorable moments from the Congress and Southfield politics for the past 30 years. Rep. Brian Postumus shares why he believes Republicans will retain a majority in the state house, even if Tudor Dixon loses by 10 points, which he says he does see happening. And what has Detroit voters pumped up? Alexis Wiley from Moment Strategies says it's all about Big Gretch. Now here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin, along with John Roerink and Danielle James.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. All right, we're going to kick off the podcast here, John and Danielle, with Alexis Wiley. You might remember her as being the chief of staff for Mayor Mike Duggan in the city of Detroit. She is now a strategist and owner of a company called Moment Strategies. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Alexis.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us what Moment Strategies is, first of all.
So we're a strategic communications and public affairs practice, really focused on really overall communications. We do some PR, but really mostly it's really how do you communicate strategically and really manage even crisis communications. That's one area where we do a lot of work. Our clients range from state of Michigan clients. We work with a number of state departments. We work with the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office and manage things for them around some of the crises that they've dealt with. And we do a few companies, and that's pretty much what we do. Just help people communicate well in the public space.
Why the name Moment?
So the name Moment for me, it was really, really personal for me, because I feel like really when it comes to communication, you can plan the right moment, or it can be something that comes right out of the blue, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to deal with it, right? And the motto I came up with was own your moment, right? Because either way, you're going to have to know what to say, know what to do. And you know, if you get an opportunity to plan for it, great, we can help you do that. But if it's something that comes out of the blue that you're going to have to figure out, we know how to help you own those moments too. So that's really where it came from.
Well, speaking about moments, we're in a moment right now where we're in a, I guess, neck deep in a political cycle, only about a month away from Election Day. Being around Detroit, I guess, what is the feel? Are people talking about it? Is there interest in this election? And if so, to what extent?
You know, as you said, I live in the city of Detroit. I watch Detroit TV. I spend my time with my neighbors in my city, and I'm very active in the city. And to be completely honest, I think the only thing that people are really fired up about is the governor. I mean, to be completely honest, I think that she's got a wide amount of support, broad support in the city of Detroit, but I don't feel like any of the initiatives have really caught fire in terms of gaining a lot of interest. Now I say that in that I think that voters are going to support all three of the ballot initiatives, right? I think that they're going to, proposal 1 to 3, they're going to support them. But I think that this is one of those elections that kind of like feels weirdly sleepy. Like it just doesn't feel like there's a ton of energy around some of the big issues. And I say that as somebody, you know, very supportive of reproductive freedom and also the transparency and term limits initiative. I think all of those campaigns are working hard to get their message out. I just think that we're in a moment where I'm gonna be very interested to see what turnout is for this election.
You mentioned that the governor has broad support. That's a little different than it was in 2018, because I specifically recall a lot of conversation that she was a little slow to start. I mean, I think she did fine in the end, but what's changed within the African-American community in terms of their support for Gretchen Whitmer?
You know, she has a really great way of communicating with people. And she's the kind of person that you see at an event. She spent a lot of time in Detroit. You see her, she's somebody who wants to shake your hand, take a picture. She's somebody who's really relatable. And in Detroit, I think that matters and goes a long way. And I also think that there's a strong feeling in the city that she worked really hard to protect people and keep them safe through the pandemic. They really have personally felt it, because when you think about kind of, for our experience in Detroit, through COVID, it was extremely traumatic. We lost a lot of loved ones. The question of whether COVID was serious was never a question for us, because our lived experience, our neighbors, you know, the fact that we lost family members, we lost so many people, it was something that was critical for us, right? And I think seeing the governor take such decisive and smart action really helped expand her base of support in Detroit.
What kind of feedback have you gotten on Garland Gilchrist as lieutenant governor?
I think people like Garland a lot. I think most people really are big fans of him. And I think one thing that's been really interesting to see is him. He's been getting out on a lot more issues, right? You saw him out I-375. He grew up not far from I-375, right in the Elmwood neighborhood. He's very active in the city. You're seeing him champion more of those issues that are very top of mind for urban communities, including digital broadband. That's a big issue that he has really taken the lead on. So I think that his support is strong. I think that he still has some, there's still some ground to be gained when it comes to expanding the number of people who know who he is. But I think it's clear that he's working really hard to do that. And I think that, you know, give him a little time and it will really, really continue.
Touching specifically on Proposal 3, you said you believe people will support it, but that they're not fired up. Could you elaborate on that?
So I think that one of the challenges you often have about reproductive freedom as an issue is in a number of the urban faith communities, there's kind of an ambivalence, right? Because you have some kind of the traditional faith-based organizations who are not, you know, I think it's been interesting to see, they're not coming out against it, right? But they're just kind of silent on it in general. I think, and the New York Times actually had a really fascinating piece about how that's the trend nationwide in urban communities when you look at reproductive freedom. So I think that people are gonna vote in support. I just think people are not out there. The rallying that you see in, you know, rallies we saw in Lansing and all that kind of stuff, I don't know how much of that is flowing through the urban communities, not just in Detroit, but across Michigan and across the country.
Well, we're hearing across the state that folks are angry, that they're frustrated, that they're really on edge. Are you feeling that in Detroit?
You know, I think, again, everybody's lived experiences. I feel like it's hard for me to say like what everybody in general is feeling, right? But what I can say is that we're at a point where things feel like they are going well in the city of Detroit, right? You feel like there are more companies coming, there are jobs being created. You just had a number of large initiatives to support people who are facing tax foreclosure. I think that there are positive things happening here. I feel like there was just an announcement Friday where the city is going to be increasing the officer pay. So that now we're going to be competitive with other communities, which is a huge issue, right? Crime, safety in our neighborhoods, huge. I think people are feeling hopeful. I don't feel as much of the anger, but I think that is so specific to your lived experience. It's so specific to what's happening with your family. Can you put food on the table? Are you working? Is your kid, do you feel like your kids are being educated? If you don't feel that, I think you are experiencing a lot of stress, but it's very much divided along economic lines and, you know, your specific neighborhood experience.
I want to ask specifically about your experience in working with the mayor, and he seems very engaged. Do you see him running for another term? What do you see coming down the line for Mike Duggan?
You know, yes, he is super engaged. I feel like he has more energy than anybody I know. And I'm a lot younger than the mayor, but I think, in case you weren't sure, but no, I think he's going to, I don't know. I would never speak for him about what he's going to do. But if you look at just judging his energy, he is, you know, there's not a lack of ideas. He's coming up with new initiatives and building on all the work. So like, you know, you often feel like when someone kind of hits their third term that things might slow down a bit. They haven't slowed down one bit for the Duggan administration in the city of Detroit. And I think that you're going to continue to see that. For him, it's going to be all about where does he feel he can be the most useful, right? Where can he make the biggest difference? Because for him, he's very much like not interested in some, you know, just making a paycheck. He's very much on like, what can I actually tinker with? What can I make it? Where can I make a difference? So I think that's going to be what he thinks about when it comes time to make those kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I've seen his tenure as being pretty amazing because these mayoral races and mayoral politics in Detroit can be pretty divisive. He just kicked butt in his last reelect. It wasn't even really much of a race at all. How has he been able to get so popular?
You know, and I ran that campaign, and that was for us, you know, really, I think one thing that, you know, people have felt like, there were people who initially, very early on, felt like, you know, they weren't sure they wanted a white mayor, right? Mm-hmm. But what they were sure of was that they wanted things to get better and they wanted to see change. So they were willing to give this guy a shot. They did it. And then every year you'd see something new happen. You'd see things get a little bit better. You see home ownership increase. You see things, more jobs and companies, and the companies that are coming are being required to hire Detroit residents. I think he's been able to really kind of show what leadership looks like. And then in the pandemic, I mean, we were the city that figured out how to do the vaccines when nobody else could figure out how to do it. We were the city that figured out how do we support our small businesses while they were suffering? How do we help them during that time? They felt comfortable. I think coming off of that, there was no question about his commitment to the city and whether he could deliver in terms of making things better. Because I think that one thing people don't really think about, when government's going right, when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, nobody really talks about you. Right. Nobody thinks about you, right? The trash gets picked up, the lights are on. I don't care. I think Detroit is really getting to that place. And it's kind of fun to see, having started in 2014, you know, February 2014 was when I started in the communications department at the city. And to see, I mean, we were on the news every single day with something that was broken, something wasn't right. And to see where we are today, we're like, there could be days where, like, you know, if the mayor doesn't have an announcement, nobody's talking about anything with the city, which is like really what you want it to be, right? You want to just deliver for people so that they can go about their lives and, you know, go about their hopes and dreams.
Now, we're in the midst of a gubernatorial campaign right now. And as I've said at MERS, it's never too early to talk about the next one. Could you see a mayor, Mike Duggan, pondering running for governor or running for governor? Would he be a good candidate?
I think I could see any number of things. I think whatever, you know, I think the mayor has shown extraordinary talent and an ability to lead in a variety of different scenarios. But I wouldn't even venture to speak on, you know, whether I could see it, but I think he's great at whatever he does.
You've never heard him say, I would never be interested in running for governor.
No, you know, I haven't really chatted with him about that. I mean, we really talk about Detroit.
Okay, fair enough. Got to ask, you know.
I appreciate it. No, you wouldn't be doing your job if you didn't.
No.
I tell you, I'm a big fan of every morning getting your headlines, and like, it is such a good download of all the stuff that matters across the state. So,
good.
I would be surprised if you didn't ask me that.
I'll share that. Good.
Yeah, kind of, you know, following up on someone different from Detroit, how do you think State Rep Sri Thanadar has been received, especially, you know, in his most recent run?
Yeah, I mean, he won. So that's, you know, a starting point for him. I mean, he hasn't completely won, right? Yeah, so we got to wait till November. So I think that he is beginning to gain some ground. People who were deeply, deeply opposed and very upset when he won, I'm hearing that he is popping up at events. He is trying to build bridges and make some friends. And I think people are taking a wait and see approach. I think that there's still very strong feeling that you know, it's deeply unfortunate that Detroit does not have one person on the federal level that reflects the majority of the population. And that's something that I think is still deeply concerning to a lot of people. But I think, though, he's trying to make friends. He's trying to make friends and trying to show that he's going to make a difference. So, again, I think that Detroit is a place where, while there are some who are very upset about this right now, I think they'll get over it to a degree if he actually delivers and shows that he can bring back things that actually improve the quality of life in Detroit. Because when we think about like what cities need, when it comes to federal resources, we need a lot, right? We've gotten a lot with ARPA and, you know, the BIL funding that's coming in and all that. But like, we still have a lot of long ways to go with the city of Detroit to really be on par with where we need to be. And that's going to require strong partners in Washington. And hopefully he will demonstrate that he could be that strong partner.
One more question I had about the Republicans trying to make ground in Detroit and with black voters. Do you feel like they're making ground? I mean, you take a look at the congressional races and they do have two black congressional candidates and their nominee for Secretary of State is a black woman. Do you feel though that they're making ground?
So I think it's an interesting question. And I think you have to take it when you look at each of those candidates. So John James, I think John is somebody that people can relate to and has a, you know, I think people are supportive. I know people who are supporting him. And again, I'm a Democrat, but I know people who are black and who are also Democrats who are supportive of John and I have a lot of respect for John because of who he is and his family. So I believe John's going to win that race. So that's, you know, that's that. I think that when you look at the rest of like Christina Caramo, I don't see her gaining any kind of traction in Detroit or with any kind of black voters because one, she hasn't made any attempt. You've seen nothing that seems like she wants to go after the black vote. And, you know, Jocelyn Benson as Secretary of State, you know, she has done a fine job. And I think people see that and will support her. I mean, what's really going to help everybody is that people are supporting Governor Whitmer, right? It's just how much. I mean, when you poll Governor Whitmer in Detroit, she's high. I mean, really, really popular. So I think that's going to carry everybody. But and I think also the things that we've heard about Christina Caramo, I just saw an attack ad that was running here in Detroit over the weekend. And I mean, it was pretty much things that people would not be, that would not make you want to get to know her more. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that. And there was nothing positive about her running on the air either. So I think, you know, Secretary of State Benson is doing a fine job and people will show up to support her.
I have to ask this to be specific. Is the Whitmer campaign one of your clients?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Just want to make sure. No. I mean, I'm.
Yeah.
Not,
no.
I'm
no. 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 And I see
saying,
that.
I just want to make sure that we're.
Yeah. No. Whitmer campaign is not a client of mine at all. Right. I've just always I really like the governor. Like I like her as a person, and I like what she's done. I like how she leads, and you know she's had to deal with a lot of really really terrible tough things that could have broken another person that she's been able to stand up to, and she's continued to show great leadership. So I just personally like her. So that's why I say all that.
Yeah, and that's why we wanted to have you on the podcast, because we remember back in 1990 when Jim Blanchard lost the governor's race due to no small part of just lack of enthusiasm in Detroit. And we wanted to check in to see if Governor Whitmer was susceptible to that same type of fate.
Yeah, I don't think so. No, I mean, she's really liked. She's really, it even's like some of the fun things like calling her Big Gretch, right? Like with the Cardi glasses and like just, she has some like fun things that have made people be like, okay, she's cool. We like her. And that's not the only reason, because I do think she does a really good job of engaging a lot of like black leaders, urban leaders and Detroit leaders. And she's just like, she just vibes really well with people. And when people, Detroit's one of those places, and I experienced it as a news reporter, once you kind of people feel like you are attracted to Detroit and you want to do the right thing, then they're going to, you know, be with you.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, thank you for your time today, Alexis Wiley. She is with Moment Strategies. Appreciate you being on the MERS podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a fun conversation to be part of or listen to. So thank you. Right now, Big Grinch said stay home. All that protesting was irrelevant. Big Grinch ain't trying to hear y'all or the president. How we gonna take orders from a non-resident? Talking about it safe, but he ain't coming with the evidence. Big Grinch got him shook now. When it's all over, you invited to the cookout.
Join us now for the podcast is U.S. Representative Brenda Lawrence. She is a Democrat out of Southfield. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So this is going to be your final few months in the job as a member of Congress. What are you going to miss the most about this job?
The people. Because we're away from our families so much in Congress, your colleagues become an extended family. It's like if you have a medical emergency at night or you don't feel good, you tell one of your colleagues, we check on each other, we have dinner together because our families aren't here. We know we have a common job ethic and we know that we attack issues. We keep track of our family. And because, you know, my colleagues have lost their families, death of their children, surgeries and things like that. And then we've had some very heated debates on issues and trying to convince our colleagues, explaining bills that we're going to issue and present. And so the thing I will miss the most is the people. And I will tell you one other thing. It's a little quirk of mine, I guess. When I came to Congress and I came over one evening and the Capitol was quiet and I'm walking the halls and I said, these halls were built by slaves. And here I am from hard work, commitment to walk these same halls. In this building, women got their rights. The civil rights laws were passed. And so when you think about the magnitude of this job and having the honor and the opportunity to continue to fight for a democracy, that's not lost on me. It was, a lot of people ask, how did you get here? I always tell people I'm a little Black girl from the east side of Detroit. No one in my family, you know, had any political role. It was just drilled into me the importance of voting. I remember when Martin Luther King was alive, sitting at the knee of my grandmother and watching her cry, watching those things that happened to Black people in the South, the dogs, the hoses, and how voting was so precious. And here I am sitting in a seat to make a difference for generations to come.
On the voting issue, I would love to hear your reaction to the Citizens Redistricting Commission, the results. It impacted, obviously, your district and impacts Detroit in a big way as a longtime Detroit resident. Share with our listeners what you think of the outcome, the product that came out.
So, you know, part of the civil rights movement was to ensure we had representation and representation for all different ethnic groups in America. And so Michigan has always had two voting rights districts. I have the honor of holding one of those. And we've always had two African-American representatives in the state of Michigan. And the saddest thing for me is that we will no longer have any African-Americans representing us in Congress. And one of the reasons for that is that they reduce the number of African Americans in each of those two seats. So we no longer had a majority African American seat as a result of the population. We brought that issue up when they were redistricting. Everyone poo-pooed and said, oh no, there's 47%, there's 43%. So you're fine. And the reality is that part of it is on my community. They didn't come out to vote in the primary. And even if all the African Americans had voted, we now have the state of Michigan, one of the largest Black populations in the country, without any Black representation. To me, that is disgraceful. And it came from that commission. And we're going to continue to raise our voices to challenge the process. And we heard discussions about other ethnic groups and how they worked hard to keep them together so that they could have representation. But for the African American, it wasn't that big of a deal. They kind of fluffed it off. And now in my leaving, having that moment walking the halls of Congress with the reality of slaves, my people, built that building. And now to have the state of Michigan with no Black representation is unacceptable.
It is possible we could get an African-American in John James, I suppose. He's a Republican, though, and you know, not from your side of the aisle. Yeah. But I see the point that you're making there. It's got to be a little weird, though, in the sense that since the days of Martin Luther King, Black individuals have made progress. But then here we are talking about the redistricting proposal and the maps, and yet it seems like we're taking some steps back. That's got to be a little frustrating for you.
Well, unfortunately, I've been in Congress where I've seen a lot of steps back. The most current one are rights for women. When you talk about Roe versus Wade, the voting rights, where democracy was not protected. It was not only protected, it was attacked. I have seen the home ownership in Black America diminish. I've seen the diplomacy of our democracy, where there was the thing we call statesmanship, or the expectation that those who take the oath of office will stay true to that. And I want to just talk about, I'm looking at history and Detroit, who has the largest Black community, has always had African-American representation. And we're talking about John James, who is an African-American. He's on the other side of the aisle. Yes, we will have a representative, if he's elected, that will have a totally different agenda. And so we have to continue to fight for democracy, diplomacy. I hope to God we never have another attack on the Capitol, which I was in the Capitol and had to run out the building. I don't know, John James hasn't stood up against that. He is still I guess Trump was just in town endorsing him. So that troubles me. Because at the end of the day, it's not the color of your skin. It's your compassion and your commitment to fight for justice for all people.
I wanted to ask you, as a member of the House Appropriations Committee, MERS, you know, we have to follow the state budget. We're required to have a state budget. It's got to be enacted. What's your assessment of is the federal appropriations process working? And has Congress kind of let up some of its own authority by not insisting on a full budget being passed and kind of going continuation to continuation?
My frustration sitting on appropriations is that we go through a rigorous debate process for fundings for programs that we're going to move forward. I've learned uniquely during the Trump administration that if we don't fund certain departments, the Department of Justice, the Department of Housing, Environmental, EPA, they can't do the work. So you don't even have to say, I don't want it. You just don't fund it. And the challenge is, because I've been in the minority and I've been in the majority, whoever is in power gets the budget. And when things that people don't think about, when they say we didn't reach a consensus and pass the budget. And we pass what we call a continuing resolution, a CR. You know in your household, excuse me, that cost of living has, especially during these last few years with COVID and supply chain crisis, that everything costs more. And we should pay our federal workers a living wage that they can, respective of their talent and skills, just like private industry. So when you hear the word CR, that means everything is held to the previous budget. So to give you an example, we have included more funding for housing, for so that we can have affordable housing. Almost every city that I talk to are having challenges with housing, and they can't do any of that. It's status quo because we have not passed the budget. There are raises that our military, we approve for our military. They can't get it because we haven't passed the budget. So it is better than a shutdown, I will tell you that, because if we don't pass a CR, then guess what? We shut the government down. You're talking about a massive quake effect in our government and people not working and bills not being paid, and it is horrible.
But to John's point, though, it just seems like it's continuation budget after continuation budget, and then there is no full year budget, and that has to be frustrating because you can't make, you know, maybe the kind of holistic progress that you'd like to make on the spending initiatives.
Exactly. It is frustrating, but the thing that I have learned being in this seat is that you live to fight another day. I would rather, because if we can't reach consensus, I can't control that. I can't control the vote of my colleagues on my side or the other side. And so I have, you keep pushing. When they say this is making sausage, that's why we celebrate a victory. Oh my goodness, we got something passed. And so I've learned to live to fight another day, because if you just get frustrated, nothing happens. You have to see where things are falling apart and dive into that and try to find a way to fix it, because that's what the American people are counting on.
You've been in office now 8 years, correct? 2014 was your first, right?
Yes.
8 years doesn't seem like that long, but a lot's changed, I guess. Can you describe for our listeners how Congress has changed since 2014?
Well, we went through COVID, where we had to learn how to do our work on video, on Zoom and whatever. And we, it was a hard time, it was an emotional time because our country was in a pandemic. We started proxy voting, which is something that was very new, where if you can't make it to be in the past, when I first came in, if your plane was delayed, you couldn't make it, you had a death in your family, it was a reason why you couldn't come to work. You just missed votes. And you're in media, you know, you used to look at the candidates, how many votes did you miss? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the greatest sin of any politician, that you don't vote. Well, now we started the proxy voting, which is very unique. We've seen impeachments of presidents. We have seen and buried members of my colleagues. I've seen three deans four deans in my term here, where they either died or had to leave because of illness. I've seen, I will tell you, I've seen a rise in African-American minorities. I've seen a rise in diversity in the Republican Party. And then I've seen the rhetoric change. Just being disrespectful to each other. You know, it's, to me, even in common everyday life, when you are a compassionate, intelligent human being, you find a way to communicate and work through our differences without making it personal. And it's been accepted because it's growing, that discord among our colleagues of being disrespectful in verbiage and sometimes just to the American people in general.
Have you had a chance to speak with Sri Tanadar yet? I guess he would technically be your successor, I guess, even though the district's wildly changed. But have you reached out, or has he reached out and you all had a conversation?
Yes, we have sat down and talked. He and I will be meeting, he and I will be meeting probably one day next week. I will say my district was, was divided up into four districts. Rashida Tlaib has one. Ailey Stevens has part of it. And Sri Tanadar has part of it.
Yeah, so there's really no likely, you can't really say Sri's the successor, but since he's the newbie, you know, I guess you're kind of handing the mantle to him. Any regrets on the decision? Do you think, I really could have given it a go in the 13th district, and we could have had that representation still within Congress for Michigan?
My decision, I am confirmed that there is a time and season for everything in your life. A few people know that I have been an elected official for 30 years. The 30 years of school board, city council, mayor, and now Congress. And that's normally considered a good career, right? Mm-hmm. And someone said something that kind of opened my eyes. They said, no one leaves at the height of their career. They said, you're at the height of your career. I would tell you the general consensus, I've been doing a fairly good job. And in Congress, that's another thing. It seems like people are choosing elected office as a lifelong career. I think the average age now in Congress is in the 70s. It is very normal to have 80-year-olds in leadership. And while I applaud that, I celebrate my 50th anniversary this year. And my husband looked me in the eye and said, for 30 years, the family had to come second. And few people, you know, you'll hear politicians saying, oh, my family comes first. When you take this job, and I give the example, when we had that power outage and half of the north part of the northeast part of the country went dark, I was the mayor. And everybody ran home to their families to make sure that I had to run to City Hall and take care of my city. When we had the attack on the Capitol, I was running for my life and my family was trying to figure out, where are you? Are you okay? When I was on school board, if there was debates or contract talks, long hours in the night, being a mayor and now here. And he said, when is our time? Mm-hmm. Brenda, 50 years of marriage, 30 years you've been doing this. When is our time? And I will continue to serve in some capacity. And I tell people, I'm not going away. It's just, I won't be doing a job that takes me away from my family 4 days out of the week, fundraising, taking care. 4 days of the week, I'm out of town. But the time I'm at home, I leave in the morning and come back in the evening. I'm still working. And it's been the most amazing opportunity. I can't tell you how thankful I am for the people that trusted me for 30 years. at casting their vote for me.
Well, we appreciate covering you, and I know the residents of Southfield and Detroit have appreciated your leadership and the sacrifices that you've made, and we wish you the very best as you enter that next stage of your life, and appreciate you taking time with us here at the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you all so much, and for everyone, this country and our democracy is worth fighting for, and I am so honored that I had the opportunity to be in that seat and pass laws and bills, take care of communities, take care of the education of our children. So this 30 year has been like a rose, a bouquet of roses that the community have given me, and I hope I've given back as much to them.
We appreciate the time. U.S. Representative Brenda Lawrence, again on the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yo, dude, this is our room.
Joining us now for the podcast is State Representative Brian Postumus. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Good morning, Kyle. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So you are running for the floor leader position for the Republican caucus, and I imagine that's taken you across the state. Am I right or am I wrong?
I am, and it definitely has taken me across the state. I've driven up to the UP to meet with candidates. I've driven all the way out to the shores of Lake Huron to meet with candidates, and down pretty much to Toledo. So I've put about 35,000 miles on my car over the last 5 months, and currently I'm on my way back down river to help out Dale Benecki and Jamie Thompson on the Doors.
So has there been a common theme that you've heard as you've been doing the Doors?
Yes, absolutely. The common theme on the Doors with the voters is a couple things. One, we can't continue on with the inflation and the gas prices the way that they are. And number two, we have to make sure that there is common sense in government and a little bit of restraint in government. You know, a lot of people have, most of the people that I'm talking to haven't forgotten that the government shut down the economy for 2 years, that the governor decided who was, who could work and who couldn't work. And people haven't forgotten about that. So those are the main themes that I've been hearing at the Doors.
When you talk about inflation with the voters, obviously this is not just a Michigan problem, it's a national problem, an international problem. What do you tell voters the legislature can do about inflation?
Look, there's not a lot that we can do specifically to address inflation or impact inflation, but what we can do is provide some relief in the pockets of the voters. And, we've put multiple tax cuts on the desk of the governor that would provide that relief, and she's vetoed every one of them.
Are you hearing that they would rather have a cut in the income tax as opposed to, let's say, a $500 rebate?
Look, we need to give the voters something that's going to be long lasting and not just a one time thing. And so that's what people I'm talking to want.
Yeah, I guess, while you're out there talking with voters, what has been the most rewarding part of this whole process? And what would you say has been the most challenging part?
Well, the most rewarding part is meeting with voters in every part of this state, whether we're talking about rural northern Michigan or Rochester Hills in the suburbs of Rochester Hills, or the cornfields of my district. You know, it's really fun to talk to and get to know people from all different backgrounds and have a better understanding that, in reality, we all want the same things. We all want a safer, better Michigan, and we all want to make sure that we can earn a living and raise our families here.
All right, so let's get a little granular since you've been at in many of these districts. Let's start in your home area of Kent County. Four competitive seats. Which seat of the grouping here do you feel the most confident about that the Republicans are going to win?
It's a toss up between Lisa DeKreiger and Lynn Afendoulis in that standpoint. If Lynn hadn't already represented most of that or a lot of that district and the Afendoulis name just wasn't so prevalent in that area, I think the edge would go to Lisa DeKreiger. That being said, with Lynn's name ID and just she's loved by everybody, based on that, I think the edge probably goes to her. But we're working hard in both of those seats. In fact, I'm going to be back in Kent County doing doors for both of them this week.
So just for our readers' benefit, there's our listeners' benefit, there's four seats. They're the 80th, 81st, 83rd, and 84th district. They all have a little slip of Grand Rapids. This 80th district, though, is more about East Grand Rapids. And that one also has Kentwood, and it's also got some Cascade in it. When you're going in Grand Rapids, what is the reception you're getting regarding Trump? That's always kind of a question mark. It seemed like Peter Meyer did better than Donald Trump in many of these areas. Is Donald Trump helping or hurting these House candidates?
Well, this election isn't about Trump. This election is about making sure that we provide relief to the voters. This is about the inflation that they're seeing and the gas prices that they're seeing.
What do you think about what you're seeing in the 84th district? That's one we haven't touched yet. Carol Glanville is running for re-election. And you have a candidate who ran as an independent during the special election, now running as Republican in this district. How is that coming along?
Mike Milanowski is a phenomenal candidate. He is doing the work that he needs to do. I was in his district, gosh, I think about 10 days ago, doing some doors for him there. And, we might surprise a lot of people in that seat. We very well could. We're certainly investing in it. HRCC is investing in it. I'm investing in it, both with time and resources. That is a seat that is an uphill battle, but it's a battle that we can win. And the fact that the Democrats are spending money in order to keep that seat really speaks volume as to where they think that they truly are as far as how many seats they're going to get, because that should be a relatively safe seat for them with an incumbent running in it now. But the fact that they're spending a lot of money in there really tells you that their chances aren't as good to gain as many seats as they're trying to portray they are.
What's going on downriver in districts like, the 28th, 27th, 29th?
So like I said, I'm heading downriver right now to do some doors down there, and we feel good about it. There's four seats down there that I think will win all four of them. We're going to Jim DeSena is a phenomenal candidate, has some decent name ID, and he's doing the work that he needs to do. We're going to pick up that seat. Dale Benecki, that is a seat that the Democrats absolutely should win, but we were able to find a phenomenal candidate there that's willing to do the work. We're investing our resources there, and the Democrats are coming in and trying to spend money too, and that shows you that again, they're spending money in seats that they shouldn't be spending money in. And to be honest, I truly think that Dale Benecki is going to win. I don't know that I'd be down there investing a lot of time if I didn't think he had a chance. Same with Jamie Thompson. And then if you look at Bob Howie, he ran, I can't remember if that was 18, but he ran before, so he has a little bit of name ID. And I think he's going to win. My polling shows him up right now, and I think that's just going to continue to get better. And so the messaging downriver is working, and the work ethic is working. So there's four seats that Republicans are going to pick up right there.
So which one of those four do you feel the most confident about? Howie, Thompson, Benecki, or DeSena?
I think they're all going to win, but I think the one that's going to have the widest margin is going to be Jim DeSena.
Jim DeSena is running against Alex Garza in that new 29th district. Is it because of the district, or is it because of DeSena as a candidate?
Well, it's a combination of both. You know, we have the perfect storm going into that race. We have Alex Garza, who lost the mayoral race in the most Democrat part of that district, and then we have Jim DeSena, who has good name ID in the area, is doing the work, resonates with the voters there, and we have solid messaging. So it's a perfect storm of all of the above.
So who would you say is the most vulnerable Democrat on the state House side?
The most vulnerable Democrat running for the House is Alex Garza against Jim DeSena.
So more than Nate Shannon, you think?
I think so, but I also think we're going to be able to pick up that seat, too. I'm confident we are going to pick up that seat. So what's interesting is, in order for the Democrats to take majority, they have to protect all of their incumbents. All of them. They can't lose any of them. They don't have a path without that. And frankly, I'm confident that we are going to take out both of those candidates, Garza and Shannon.
Your most vulnerable incumbent right now is?
If you look at it on pen and paper, I would say Jack O'Malley. That being said, I wouldn't want to run against Jack O'Malley with a 10-point advantage. So a lot of people would consider Jack O'Malley in that position. But, Jack is one of the most effective legislators our state has seen in a very, very long time. He is well loved by the people in his district. He's well known by the people of his district. Has virtually unanimous name ID, and it's just one heck of a candidate. So while on paper it would probably be Jack O'Malley, I still think he wins that race with a couple point buffer.
With that in mind, is there concern about some of the recent Dem advice in that district?
Oh, anytime a Democrat is spending money in a race that we want to hold on to, then yeah, there's concern about that. But we're going to match them and we will outspend them. The fact of the matter is, House Republicans have a significant cash advantage over the Democrats, significant, both in our caucuses and then also with individual members that are willing to help out vulnerable candidates or candidates that need extra funding. And so I can tell you that Republicans will outspend the Democrats in that seat. And I can tell you that we welcome that, because the more money they spend in other seats, the less money we're spreading them thin. And you can see that in their buys. You know, while we were up in 18 different seats, they were focusing on four. And of those four that they were focusing on, I think they're going to still lose three. Sure, they expanded their map last week, but we were already in more races than they expanded to. And so it's clear they just can't compete with our cash advantage.
As you talk to your colleagues in the House, and as you talk to these candidates running out in the field, is there a consensus among Republicans about the role that Proposal 3 will play, that the abortion issue will play? And is there concern? What's your take?
I guess I'm not sure what you're asking by asking.
Is there a concern among Republicans running for the House that the abortion issue is going to pump the turnout up for Democrats?
Proposal 3 is going to drive turnout. It's going to drive some turnout for the Democrats. It's going to drive turnout for the Republicans. This is not just a Democrat issue. This is an issue that everybody is thinking about, and everybody has some thoughts on. The reality of it, though, is as we get the messaging out on this, it's becoming clear to the voters that Proposal 3 is just so extreme. When we're talking about people being allowed to have abortions not in a medical facility, children being able to get abortions without the consent of their parents, it's becoming clear this is an anything goes proposal, and most people believe that there absolutely should be some restrictions on it.
So what number are you concerned about Tudor Dixon hitting before it starts impacting the House Democrat or the House Republicans?
Look, I mean, gubernatorial races have a tendency to have the Republican coming in from behind. That's a historic trend that we know happens. The other historic trend that we know happens in 100 years of data and 200 years of election history is that the party that holds the executive branch federally in the midterm elections has a rough go at it. And so, well, sure, if she loses by more than 12, that's going to have some impact down ballot. That being said, I don't think her losing by 12 is even in the realm of possibility right now.
But if Tudor Dixon wins, the House Republicans retain majority.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So, but if it's a 5-point race, so let's say it's 53-47 or 48 or something, somewhere in that area, then what would you say? Is it a 50-50 shot the Republicans come out with the majority in the House?
No, if Tudor Dixon loses by 5 points or less, then Republicans are going to pick up seats in the House. Tudor Dixon loses by less than 10, then I think Republicans still maintain majority in the House. And if she loses by less than 5, I think we're going to be closer to 60 seats in the House.
You mentioned that historically Republicans in gubernatorial races come from behind and they narrow the gap. I remember that happening with your dad when he ran in 2002. Was that a race that you had in mind? And do you see any similarities between the two?
That was absolutely one that I had in mind, but it's also a historic trend outside of my dad's race. You know, I believe about a month out in my dad's race, he was down by double digits as well, and he ended up losing only by I think like a point and a half or somewhere in there, 2 points, and so that's the historic trend, and that's going to continue.
No question, that was a tight race. I believe the final margin was 4 points between Granholm and Posthumus. But moving ahead here, how concerned are you about the money advantage Democrats have right now over Tudor Dixon, the Republicans?
So it really depends on what the governor is going to be spending her money, where she needs it to go in order to boost her numbers. And so while I'd rather the governor not have a sizable cash on hand advantage, it's not going to make or break the election for Republicans down ticket.
How many races do you see being in play right now?
In play. So I would say there's 16. We're in about 18 races right now.
How many are you on the air on?
I believe we are on the air in 12, but I don't know that for sure.
Do you see the Matt Hall seat being one of those seats that are in play?
On paper, yes. In reality, no.
Because I did see that there is some advertising going on in that Kalamazoo County district.
There's different strategy at play, and that's some things that probably don't want to get into all the detail about. But we're trying to spread the map. We're trying to ensure that the Democrats are spread too thin and can't compete with us.
Well, I certainly know that has happened in the past. The Democrats have tried to play in more seats than they were able to afford, and then ended up losing those seats and the ones that they probably should have won as well.
Well, and that's typically what happens when one caucus has a substantial cash on hand advantage, and that's the case in both the House and the Senate.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Representative Brian Posthumus. He's a Republican from Cannon Township.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Also, our guests today, Alexis Wiley, Representative Brian Posthumus, and Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence. Also, like to thank Mark Bayshore. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. For Danielle James and the boss, John Roerink, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.